Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet, by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Return of the Unexplained. Well, up here in the Northern Hemisphere, we are getting ready for autumn. It is the back end of the summer, and another year sets to wrap itself up. Well, you know, that's how things are. People keep telling me that you have to seize every moment in life, and sometimes I haven't. Maybe you're the same. And the years seem to pass so quickly, don't they? Maybe the older you get, the quicker they go by. A psychologist explained this to me on the radio recently. He said, the reason we think as we get older that the years go quicker is that sometimes a lot of the things we've done in a year, we've done before in other years, and we tend to almost erase those from our short-term memory, or certainly put them on the back burner. And so the reason things appear to go quickly is that just simply we skip through certain parts of the narrative of the year, if I'm making sense here. And that's why a year seems to be shorter when you get older, if indeed it does for you. Which sounds like a very good explanation for it, but it's certainly happening to me. Going to do some shout-outs on this edition. If you've been in touch, thank you very much. Please keep your emails coming. I'd like to know what you think of the show, how it can be improved, and who should be on it. Way that it should be done, that kind of thing. Go to my website, created and honed by Adam Cornwell from Creative Hotspot in Liverpool. Go to the website, theunexplained.tv, follow the link from there, and you can send a message to the show, or you can leave a donation if you'd like to. And if you have recently, thank you very much indeed. Remember, this show online is completely and totally independent. All right, now, what else have I got to do? There's something that's been bugging me lately. And we've discussed this before here, but just one or two comments about conversations or interviews, if you want to call them that, that I've done. And, you know, some people occasionally claim that I've been, say, hostile to a guest, or I didn't understand them, or I appeared not to like them. I don't think I've ever been hostile to a guest. What I have done is obviously put the opposite point to the guest in order to elicit information from them. What I think and how I feel about particular guests is not really important. How you feel about it all, because the show is done for you, is the most important thing. My feelings about a guest, I might absolutely loathe somebody, or might absolutely love them and be a huge fan of them, but it isn't my job to be visiting my views on you here, I don't think. Now, I know there's a bit of a difference between the way that things are done in the US, where a lot of talk show hosts make a living out of going on and saying what they think, and taking a particular political, for example, stand. But here in the UK, we tend to balance stuff. And, you know, that can either be a good thing or a bad thing. But that's the training that I come from, that if you are balanced, you get more information out of the guest. And, you know, my feelings about people that I have on here are mostly private. But I have to tell you that an awful lot of the people I've had on this show I really like, you know, even if it hasn't sounded that way because I've asked them tough questions. So maybe that gives you a clue about some things. I don't know. I do know that there are times when you simply can't win. And that can be, for me, very dispiriting, but you've got to keep on keeping on, haven't you? Shout-outs, as I say, we're going to do those in this edition. I'm going to do as many as I can. If I don't get to your email, please know that I have seen it, but we'll do as many as we can on this edition. And if you want to contact me, you now know how to do that. Please keep the emails coming. They're very important to me. And when you get in touch, by the way, tell me who you are, where you are, and how you use the show. Okay. Hannes, thank you very much for the guest suggestion. I'm going to check it out, Hannes. Sherry enjoyed the show that I did with Guy McCourt. Boy, Sherry, that was a chiller, wasn't it? Brendan in Melbourne. Seem to have a lot of listeners in Melbourne, Australia. Nice to hear from you, Brendan. John in Ireland, thank you for the email about my show with Australian Fiona Horn, the rock star, pilot, and witch. You made me smile, John. Thank you. Derek and Adrian, nice to hear from you. Also good to hear from you, Ryan. Wayne in Enfield near London has been listening through the back catalogue. Well done. Thank you, Wayne. Alyssa, thank you for your email. Laura, thank you for your suggestion. Nice comments about the show from Jonathan near Havant, which is near Portsmouth in Hampshire. I used to work on Ocean FM and Power FM in that area years ago. Lonnie Lewis in Ohio, thank you for your communication, Lonnie. Same to Keith Nielsen. Don, thank you for your email. Don says that he would like to hear me on Midnight in the Desert in the US. I think there are some people who'd like to see me in the desert. Ed, thank you very much. Don, rather. Thank you very much. Ed, in Fort Worth, Texas, Nice words on my Rupert Sheldrake show. Thank you for that. Andy asks if the radio interview that I did quite recently about the Dr. David Kelly case will ever be put on here as a podcast. Yes, I plan to do that. I don't put a lot of the radio material on here, even though after a certain period of time, not very much time, it is completely lost, because people sometimes complain if I put radio show material on here. They say, oh, we've heard that before. So I have to walk a very fine line between putting the best of the radio show here for posterity to keep it and, you know, letting people hear stuff that they've heard before. So that's why we don't put very much of it on here. Plus, of course, this is a completely independent show and this will always be here and has been here for all the years that we've been doing it. So this Unexplained is the original and is the one that will always be here, whatever. You know, as long as I'm drawing breath, that is, and as long as my financial situation doesn't put me on the street. But that's another issue. Dan, thank you for your email. From Tony. Tony says, love the Unexplained show. Would like to listen to the one on the radio. I work nights, though, when it's on. I've enjoyed the show when I've had a chance to listen. Is it available online? Yes, it is on their website, but not for a long period. And like I say, I do put some of the choice material from there on this podcast. But like I said, for the reasons that I just explained, this is different and has a different feel to it and, you know, has its worldwide audience. And, you know, I want to keep it that way. So it's nice to have those two products, I guess you could call them that. Thank you very much for your support. And I will always try to do my best. You know, I'm a human being. I have my flaws. We all do. But I'm trying to learn and I'm trying to be better as I go forward. A guest on this edition of the show, a man called Michael Feely, former policeman, who's done nearly two decades of research in paranormality, mysticism, and various other things. I think you'll find him interesting. This edition is going to be an introduction to the work of Michael Feely, so I hope you enjoy it. If you want to send me an email, a reminder, it is theunexplained.tv. Follow the link on the website, and you can email me from there. And it's always very good to hear from you. Let's get to Michael Feely in the UK. Michael, thank you very much for coming on my show.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you again for the platform.
Well, you were suggested by listeners, and, you know, I often get very good suggestions from my listeners, so thank you to them, because otherwise I wouldn't have known about you. Whereabouts are you, Michael?
I'm in a little town called Tamworth in Staffordshire, which is literally about 20 minutes outside of central Birmingham in the United Kingdom.
Okay, well, I know the area well, because I used to work there. It's the heart of the United Kingdom, pretty much.
It's certainly the ancient capital of Mercia, and has lots of sort of English Civil War history and things like that. Battle of Bosworth is close by as well, so it has quite a bit of history.
Well, it does, and as I discussed on a recent radio show, of course, it very close to you is the birthplace of William Shakespeare, and there's lots of stuff being said about him these days. You know, who was he and all the rest of it. Stratford-on-Avon, just up the road from you. There's an awful lot of history around you, that's for sure.
Yeah, it is very nice to be sort of in the middle of it, but it's really good to walk around and have a look.
Yeah, I miss it. I used to live in that area. Now, all right, let's talk about you. Retired or former police officer, that's your background, isn't it?
It certainly is. I'm not retired. I actually resigned and left in 2009 after 17 years service on the front line in both London and Birmingham. But yes, my history or my background is in law enforcement and also evidential gathering and sort of crime scene preservation and things like that. So it stood me in good stead for the kind of sort of research that I do now.
Well, yeah, I think it probably would. I don't know if you know anything about me. There's no reason why you should. My dad was a policeman, so I come from a police family. And the one thing that it does is it makes you methodical. My father would be able to spot things about situations and people that other people couldn't. And I'd say to him, Dad, how did you know that? And he'd just say, copper's instinct. That was what it was.
Absolutely. I can certainly empathise with that. Yes, I can spot secret symbols. I can spot ancient codes. I can piece them together as if it was a sort of an ancient crime scene. Not a crime scene as such, but certainly a larger picture, a bigger picture that I can actually spot evidence in these monuments and in these biblical scriptures and certainly the ancient past that most people are not able to actually see, and I can sort of spot it instantly.
Okay, well, I guess we can see this conversation as a sort of introduction to you. And the thing that drew me to you first was a little ebook that you've done called Police Encounters. Now, I know from my dad's experience that police have to go places at times when other people are not around, and they have to deal with things that other people wouldn't want to deal with. And, you know, he had encounters that you could only call paranormal in his career. Certainly ghost encounters, without a doubt. He used to tell the stories of those things. And, you know, he was a fully trained man, very credible, ex-army, then into the police. He was not a man who was about to make up stories, but he had encounters all the way through his career. So what we're saying is, I think, if you have a uniform on, the chances that you're going to see things and encounter things that other people don't are quite high.
I think that's correct. And again, when you know, if you're in the Air Force, you're a pilot or a fighter pilot or a civil pilot, because you are technically really an expert witness. And if anything is going to show, it's going to show to credible people, surely. And some of the things that I've witnessed, I've had spirits come back from Victorian England. They've shot 159 years in time, asked me to investigate their murder. I've seen dimensional portals opening up in front of me in the sky at night where some kind of craft has emanated. I've seen dimensional portals open up in front of me in dense forestry. I've seen so many different UFOs that you have just lost count. I've sort of been involved in a potential UFO mass landing. I've been involved in seeing the ghost of historical figures such as King Charles I, and that was in the middle of my hometown in Tamworth. So there's so many different things. I've even bumped into an extraterrestrial being face to face. So there's so many different things that happened to me from 2009 onwards that it really put me on a completely different path.
People listening to this will be asking, how come, you know, I would love to have encounters like that. A lot of people would, just for the sheer interest, if you're interested in these things. How come all these things are happening to you?
Well, that's a very good question. It's one that I've pondered over and asked many, many times. To go from sort of a standard, well, anything but standard, really, but in terms of standard career, in terms of just doing a normal job, to completely flipping 360 degrees to literally every day something will happen. And it's not as intense now as it once was. It tends to be slightly different to what it used to be, whereas I used to physically see things that other people around me never seemed to be able to see. You know, seeing three massive cigar-shaped UFOs above my hometown in the middle of broad daylight. And there's only myself and my wife who was seemingly able to see them. And other things that we're seemingly just a few people are able to see as well. So it seems like certain people can be in tune, or their frequency can be altered to become in tune.
Well, that's what I hear from a lot of people I've spoken with. And, you know, one of the questions, and forgive me for this question, but you'll have heard it before, is when you have these experiences, you know, one of the things that I suppose you do is you say, now, is something going on with me? Am I okay? I guess you've been through all of that.
Again, absolutely. I mean, I certainly know that I'm of sound mind. I've certainly had people accuse me of being more delusional, or, you know, there's something inside my mind that is projecting these images that I'm seeing. But I know that's not the case. And I know that what I've seen, having eliminated everything else, I know that what I've seen was actually there because of the people. You know, I've been with friends or my wife, and they've seen exactly the same thing. So there's a sort of small select group of people around me that is able to see as well. But the vast majority of people, when I've seen things in the middle of sort of crowded towns, seemingly nobody else seems to be able to see some of the things that I'm seeing.
But those closest to you have seen them?
Yep. I mean, certainly when I met my wife in 2006, she was also a police officer, and we both left at the same time in 2009. But probably about a year or so after we met, lots and lots of things started to happen to both of us together at the same time. And I think there's some kind of synchronicity going on there where sort of combined for some reason, and as a result of us getting together and sort of completing that circle, lots and lots of things have become open to us.
Okay. I mean, to some people it will sound unlikely, but I have heard stories of this kind before, and I'm certainly not that much of a skeptic that I would say, oh, these things couldn't possibly have happened to you. It just seems that there is something about you then, and perhaps you and your wife, that phenomena are attracted to.
I think so. I mean, both of us, we have a lot in common, certainly through our childhood, certainly through our upbringing. And around about the same age, maybe about 6 or even 7 years of age, we both started to get a real sort of strong, overwhelming feeling that we didn't belong. There was something different. We were asking adult questions about our existence and how this system on Earth doesn't actually make sense. And this was sort of from the age of about 6 or 7. So from a very, very young age, we're beginning to notice different things in ourselves. And as I say, to people who have never experienced, it may well seem unlikely, but if you put it in a scientific way, human beings with our 5 senses and our 7 colours, we actually see less than 1% of the frequency spectrum. Now, the frequency spectrum is basically the universe, and great scientists such as Einstein and Nikola Tesla will tell you that the universe is made up of vibration and frequency. So we are very, very sort of limited, and to put it into computer terms, our bandwidth is very limited. So the question that people need to ask themselves is, what exists in the 99%+ of that frequency spectrum that we don't ordinarily see? Because that is where the majority of these things are actually happening. And occasionally, we will tune in to a certain frequency. And when we do that frequency, that is when we start to see these things, the UFOs, the ghosts, the spirits, and all of these things that are really operating around us. And that's purely what I found. And I think that is really an answer as to why, when I'm in a crowded street, there's only me and the wife and maybe one or two other people who can see things where the majority of people are just going around their normal business as if they're completely oblivious to what's going on.
Okay. Did the fact that you both left the police force at the same time, was that connected with any of this?
We were becoming very, very disillusioned, probably about 12 months before we actually resigned and left. And we were becoming very, very disillusioned because of how the politics was entering into the system. And it was actually preventing us from doing the job that we'd actually joined to do.
So it was the practical concerns of a practical police officer, which, you know, you hear a lot of police officers express these days. It wasn't anything to do with the paranormality.
Well, it was actually a combination of both. Again, because we were becoming very, very disillusioned and we were getting really, really sort of sick and tired of being there, then all of a sudden we have all of these paranormal things happening to us as well around about the same time. And that really gave us a final push because it was really, really so intense that it was every day or every night we would see or experience something. So if you sort of marry the complete disillusionment with the career and then all of these fantastic things that were happening as well that made us realize that there's something going on beyond this reality, and that this reality on the scale of things isn't that important. And when you start to look at it in that kind of text and that kind of context, then you realize that why should you spend your life being miserable doing a job that you no longer enjoy doing?
Now, it would be easy, I think, and, you know, I get emails from people all the time, it would be easy for a skeptic to say, well, you know, there's something mental going on here, or there's, you know, the person that you're talking to is misguided. But there are two of you in this.
It's easy for a skeptic to say anything. It's easy for anybody to say anything. I mean, you know, anyone can say what they like and they can accuse people of what they like. But the fact is that we've witnessed these things, we've seen these things, and maybe one day those skeptics will see things as well. It's not a case for me to just see something and then all of a sudden say, that's paranormal, that's a ghost, that's a UFO. That is quite a lengthy process of elimination that is going on first before I will come to any sort of conclusions. But it's easy for people to scorn and mock, and, you know, people have scorned Galileo, people have scorned all these Socrates and Plato, and all these people have been scorned, and it comes about that they were actually correct. So I would really ask these skeptics to sort of refrain from such judgment.
And until they know themselves. I understand what you're saying. What was it that made you want to come out and talk about the experiences?
I think because for me, there are lots and lots of people who are also experiencing lots of things as well. And I think it puts some kind of a semblance of order on it for them as well. To see people who have been, you know, like police officers, and I was classed as an expert witness in any court in the United Kingdom, an expert eyewitness. You know, I have 17 years of evidential background. I've seen things and done things, and I can spot evidence that the average person will never, ever see or ever, ever know, as we said at the beginning of the interview. So when you have two police officers coming out and saying, well, we've seen these kind of things as well, I think it helps people to put some kind of a semblance of order on that for themselves.
Looking at your website, one of the things I was going to get to later, but you mentioned it already, and it is fascinating. You say that you were asked, both of you, to intervene and solve, or certainly investigate, a 159-year-old murder case. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, it was something that had been with my wife throughout her childhood, because where she used to live as a child in Birmingham was, as we subsequently found out, was the scene of a murder on the 9th of February, 1850, Victorian England. And there was this young girl, and through the help of a medium, she basically said that her death was covered up. She wanted us to look into it. What we subsequently found out is that she was murdered by her stepfather. Her stepfather was also around us as well, and he was smashing windows in the house and causing all kinds of really nasty things to happen.
What, without the medium present? So that this spirit, this entity, was approaching you without anybody there to intercede?
Well, it was basically around trying to prevent us from looking into this murder. And we would literally be sitting in the living room, and all of a sudden there would be 6-foot double glazed just smashing from the inside.
Okay, we lost you for a second. I just want to explain to my listener that we do have some connection problems with you. You're on a mobile connection. We very occasionally miss the word. You were saying the panes of glass?
Yeah, we had a 6-foot double pane of glass in the living room, and it actually just shattered from the inside out. You could actually see a point of sort of entry on the inside that had just been smashed. I'd have sort of attempt possessions of my body and all kinds of things, and this stepfather was trying to prevent me from and my wife looking into this girl's
when
murder.
When you say attempt possessions of your body, what does that mean?
It basically means that you can tell that there's some kind of entity that is not you attempting to take control of you. And I sort of somehow just had this innate understanding that this was happening to me. I was going tunnel visioned. I could feel a darkness around me. I could feel myself going very, very short-tempered and aggressive. I could see that things in the room were not right. It was very, very sort of tunnel visioned, like a dark cloud. And I sort of had a sense that something was trying to actually take control of me. And having seen the likes of transfiguration in mediums and other people, these kind of things, you know, I am aware that these kind of things do happen. So something was trying to take over me, and I did actually stop that from happening. Then I came round as if coming out of a trance, and I was okay again. But what happened is we were sort of kicked out of our house by the things that were going on, and we went to stop at the mother-in-law's house. And about 3:30 that morning, I remember being taken back to an old wooden cottage bedroom. I was seemingly looking through someone's eyes who was lying on a bed. In the right-hand corner of the room, there was a wooden door, and as the wooden door opened, I could see the wind from that door sort of making the curtains move. And then I heard a young girl's voice saying, "Here he is." And what I subsequently found out is I was being taken back in time to actually see or witness or see the last moments of this young girl's life. Just as she was smothered by her stepfather, who tried to cover up the event as they did in Victorian England. So that really was sort of a traumatic time, and I couldn't actually get out of bed without the light on for 6 months after that.
My God, when was this again? You told me when it was. I not the crime, but when you were experiencing this.
It was on the actual reliving the murder or witnessing in a graphic way the last moments of her life was on the 9th of February 2009, which was probably a few months before we actually left the police force.
Right. And did you not think at that time that maybe you were getting into something, both of you, a little too deeply? Maybe it was stuff that it would be very hard for anyone to handle.
I think the thing is, we never asked for it. We never went, you know, we didn't go to sort of seances. We didn't use Ouija boards. We never wanted this. We never asked for this. It came to us. And lots of things subsequently came to us. So it's not something that we delved in unknowingly or unwittingly. It was something that found us. And I think that the very fact of our careers and the fact that this young girl had been with my wife all of her life through childhood, I mean, even children, when she was young and children would come over to stay, that they'd come downstairs and say, you know, can you go and tell that little girl upstairs that I don't want to play anymore? And people would go white because they realised there was no one else up there. And there's all of these strange things that were happening in that sort of area, in that sort of house. And that was brought with her. And when we got together, then I sort of inherited the history of that story. And that's sort of, that's how I became involved in it.
And do you think that because the two of you were police officers, the spirit or whatever it is of this girl wanted you to solve this mystery somehow from the other side, wanted this mystery to be solved and brought out into the open through you?
Yeah, that's exactly what she said when she came through the medium to speak to us. She basically stated that she'd been taken by the hands of another, and that is verbatim quote. And that obviously means taken by the hands of another, if there's some kind of crime or something has happened against her, against her will. So she did actually want us to look into it and reveal what had happened to her, which we did. And then the matter was resolved. But certainly the following 6 or 7 months for me and the wife, we weren't able to actually sleep at night without the light on, because it really sort of exposes all the things that were going on. But she did say one of her parting words, which we thought was strange, was that her favourite colour was pink and lilac. And probably several days later, maybe 3 days later, my wife and I got home, and when we went into the kitchen, there was an artificial pink and lilac flower that had been left in the kitchen for us, and it certainly wasn't there before we went out, and it certainly wasn't anything to do with us or our house.
And only so, you knew about that reference?
Only we knew about the pink and lilac reference. Mm. So to us, she'd actually returned to say, look, I'm okay, thank you. But it was a traumatic time, but that we would pinpoint that as being what we would class as an awakening to greater things.
I have to say that if my life was being disturbed to the extent that your lives were being disturbed by whatever we were looking into at that point, I would tend to say, I don't want any more of this. Did that thought not cross your mind?
Well, we did. We had a private lunch and we'd literally spent, because initially we didn't have a time of the event. So my wife and I spent the whole day at Birmingham Central Library looking at every death under the name that we'd been given by this girl. And because we didn't have a date, we sort of said, well, let's go back to maybe around about the Second World War, that kind of time, or just before, because that is when the estate that the wife used to live on would have sort of been built. But we couldn't find anything. So we went for what we thought was a private lunch. And it was a quiet hotel in our hometown. And there was literally just my wife and I there. And we was having a private conversation that basically said, look, we've gone as far as we can with this. But as soon as we got home, things started to sort of go really bad for us in the house. And radiators and whatever which were on, themselves off. It was going freezing cold. There's all kinds of things going on. We called the medium up and said, look, you know, we spoke to you several weeks ago. You said you would help us to move this girl onto to a realm she should be. These things are now happening. We need some kind of help. And I said, ironically, the house has now calmed down quite a bit. And she said, that's because she's now here with me, saying that you promised to help and you haven't. So from that point, it was almost like then a teenage sort of a tantrum. And there's all these things happening. And we'd arranged to see the medium the following day. Now, the following morning, this medium's washing machine, which wasn't even switched on, had actually lifted off the floor. She said she'd actually put a cup of coffee on the breakfast bar. And when she went to retrieve it, it had been moved and it put on the windowsill of the living room with a silver spoon stuck inside it. So that she was getting quite concerned herself. Bearing in mind that she'd been sort of dealing with spirits and dealing with friendship for most of her life, this is the first time that she would become very, very anxious in her own property.
Okay, so you're telling me that in a way you wanted to pack it in, not do it, but because you hadn't seen it through, you hadn't finished it, you're almost being held to ransom by this.
We were, and as I say, from that point on, once we decided You know, we don't have a date, we don't have a time. We spent literally the whole afternoon, the whole day in Birmingham Library looking at every single deaf. And she gave us the name of Sarah Jensen. And people of the wife's estate, some of the old people who'd lived there for many, many years, had actually heard of this story. So it was actually a true story. And we looked at every name, that name from every year, from before the Second World War to the present day, which was 2009. We couldn't find anything. And it's like, well, where can we go from here? You know, we have no forensic evidence. We've not been to the scene. We have no knowledge of what had happened. We've just been asked to look into this death time frame for. And again, I thought, we thought it was a private conversation, but certain words that we used were repeated back to us. So it wasn't a private conversation. And that was, quite traumatic as well, to have this private conversation repeated back to you. So it was from the point of that decision that things started to go sort of downward in a downward spiral, and lots of negative things began to happen. But, we were quite steadfast. We sort of turned it around, and we did actually sort of establish what had happened.
Right. And so give me, if you would, a chain of events then. What had you proved, you think, by the intercession of spirit happened?
What had happened is this girl used to be abused by her stepfather, and the witnessed the door opening to the young girl saying, "Here he is," was the morning. It was 3:30 in the morning on the 9th of February. And this stepfather coming to the bedroom to abuse his stepdaughter. She'd fought back, and he basically smothered her and accidentally killed her. And she wouldn't leave this realm, because in her time, this had been covered up, and she wanted the truth to come out. And she wouldn't leave this realm until the truth had been revealed. And once she'd basically told us what had happened, once she'd been assisted to leave this realm, she was quite reluctant to leave this realm, because she believed that she was going back to the family that had betrayed her. And as a result of that, she didn't want to go back. But eventually she did go back, and the psychic medium who helped us with her also helped us with her assailant. And he was such a resistance that this psychic medium was actually ill for many months to follow. It had taken it out of her that much. She was physically ill for a long time.
There was a whole intense drama, you say, being played out, not only with you, but the medium, between this girl who wanted justice to be done, the perpetrator who wanted justice not to be done, and all of them messing with all of you.
Yeah, it was almost like a theatre of dreams acting out in our time, in our house. And it certainly was that, and it was for quite a few years. And the medium told us that she used to sit in our bedroom, she used to sit under the windowsill. And there's certain synchronicities that now make us realise that is in fact the case. But yet it was really sort of a drama, sort of 159 years into our time, that was still being played out.
Now, you managed to get yourself free of it. Wasn't that the point, to stop doing all of this?
But again, we did sort of, solve that mystery. We did reveal the story for this girl, and we did have that successful conclusion, because she then moved on to where she should be. But again, we didn't intend for it to continue. It just continued. And from that point on, let's say, we would see lots and lots of UFOs. We'd see what you would class as shadow people. We'd have sometimes at 6 o'clock in the morning, our bedroom door being rattled violently. I'd come out of the bedroom and see a shadow walking through the wall. I'd see lots and lots of UFOs. I'd see dimensional gateways opening up. I'd see craft coming out of them. So these things, again, continued to happen. And it wasn't something that we actively sought. It was something that just continued from that point on.
Well, apart from seeing a medium, if I was going through those things with the best will in the world, I would also want to consult a psychiatrist and ask what is going on with my head, that this stuff is appearing to me.
Again, that is a possible option for you. But as a result of what had happened to us, we began to look deeply into what really exists beyond this reality. And as a result of really doing some deep sort of heartfelt research into what happens beyond this reality, that sort of made us realize that there's lots of things going on beyond this reality. And all that, all this occurrence had actually done to us was open us up to a continuous sort of wider reality. So,
okay. And how would you describe, just talk to me a little more about the wider reality. How does that work?
Well, the wider reality is that in this universe, there is no such thing as empty space. In the vacuum of the universe, there is a foundation that is a tetrahedron, which is a pyramid, which again, we can then go into sort of the Great Pyramid of Egypt and the pyramids around the world. But inside this vacuum of space, that is a tetrahedron. The tetrahedron is the model of consciousness. So everything is sort of connected by an awareness. It just so happens that most people on this planet have little awareness of what is really going on beyond their senses, beyond their seven colors, beyond their five senses. And that wider reality is, as I mentioned earlier on, is what is happening in that 99%+ of that frequency that we ordinarily cannot see or sense or pick up.
Mm. It's hard to prove this, isn't it?
It is, but what? I mean, again, you know, people are sentenced to life in prison on the basis of eyewitness accounts. Most sort of evidence in court is eyewitness testimony. And when I've given evidence in court, it is mainly eyewitness testimony. So what burden of proof do people really want? I mean, if you see something with your eyes, people say that you're delusional. If you take a picture with a camera, people say that it's something, you know, something wrong with a lens. If you take a video, people say it's computer generated. So what burden of proof do people actually want? For me, to see something, to physically sense it, to have it around you, to see it happening, is proof. And that could stand up in any court in this country, because most evidence is eyewitness evidence, and that to me is proof enough.
You say that I think it goes for both of you, your first encounter with something that we might call extraterrestrial, you believe, was in 2007, so it was a couple of years before you both left the police service, you say. A strange vortex, it appears to be from the diagram that you got on your website, near the Colosseum in Rome. What was that?
Well, yes, we just had a sort of a city break weekend, and we were walking through central Rome towards the Colosseum, and I could see Sarah. She just stopped walking, and she was looking sort of in the distance in the sky. So naturally, it's just human nature to say, well, what are you looking at? So I started looking in the same direction, and what appeared to be sort of a whirlwind, a tornado-type shape. And we observed this literally for several minutes, and it was this vortex that suddenly changed shape. It became a sphere, and then it became two spheres. These spheres began sort of shooting around the sky as if being controlled. There's some kind of controlled mechanism there, and they'd be shooting around the sky, then they'd re-emerge as one sphere, then they change shape again. And we watched this for several minutes, and then all of a sudden it disappeared. And it wasn't laser, it wasn't a tornado, it wasn't anything that we would naturally ordinarily understand. Mm-hmm. And that was really something that to this day is really still unexplained to us.
Now, we have to say that if you haven't been, I'm talking to my listener, if you haven't been to the Colosseum, it is an area of intense history. It's a wonderful place to go to, and around it are remnants of ancient Rome. But from what I recall of it, there's an awful lot of dust around there because you're talking about ancient monuments. Are you sure that what you saw wasn't some kind of dust storm?
Oh, no, certainly it wasn't a dust storm, because, I say, it changed from sort of a tornado to a sphere, and then that sphere sort of merged into two spheres. They would then shoot around the sky. They would then reemerge as one single sphere that would then, again, shoot around the sky.
No, that's no kind of dust storm that I've ever encountered, I have to say. Did anybody else see this? Were you able to talk to anybody there about it?
No, again, as far as I'm aware, I mean, it's central Rome, that there are other people around. I'm not aware of anybody else has seen it. However, we didn't speak to anyone. We spoke amongst ourselves, and believe me, we spoke about it all night. It certainly wasn't anything orthodox. It certainly wasn't any dust storm that I'd ever seen. And I've been in the Egyptian desert and seen dust storms and sandstorms. This is nothing that I'd ever seen before.
Did you report it to any of the UFO reporting organisations?
Yes. When we came back to the UK, we did have at one point, and I've subsequently do talks for them as well. We had sort of contact with a Birmingham UFO group, and incidentally, there was one incident that happened when we were on night shift, where we actually came home at 7 o'clock in the morning, reported it to the Birmingham UFO group, and as we were emailing them, our emails were removed, seemingly copied, and then put back. Our phones were tapped from that point onwards, and we believe by GCHQ as a result of the communications between ourselves and this Birmingham UFO group. This Birmingham UFO group have investigated several of our sightings, and again, they're just as perplexed as we are.
And you think that the security services were taking an interest in you because of this?
Absolutely, because of the things that we were seeing and seeing regularly. At one point, one evening, was on duty with paramedics, and I looked up in the sky, and there was a ball of fire, and it looked like there was an aeroplane, because where we worked in inner city Birmingham wasn't too far from Birmingham Airport. And the paramedics and other police officers saw this as well. It looked like an aeroplane on fire. And as it came over, I took a picture of it, which is in the ebook, which bore no resemblance to what we saw with the naked eye. And it came around a couple of times. Ironically, a few weeks later, the police helicopter was on its way back to Birmingham Airport on a night shift, followed by a ball of fire, and it was all recorded on inboard cameras. Birmingham Airport refused them permission to land, and all the logs were restricted, and nobody could access to it.
How do you know that?
Because I was on duty at the time, and the police helicopter was followed by an orange ball of fire.
Similar to the one that you'd seen?
Almost exactly similar to the one. We've been a couple of miles of where I had seen it previously.
Mm-hmm. And do you know anything about the reports the crew of the helicopter would have made after that? Because I guess they'd have had to have reported something.
Well, it would have gone to the Civil Aviation Authority, maybe even the MOD, but because everything was instantly restricted, nobody had access to what was being said subsequently. So I don't know to this day what the report was. I know there's lots and lots of pilots that see things that are specifically asked, do you wish to report this? And they turn around and say, no.
And of course, a lot of pilots in history have chosen not to report things that they've encountered because they've feared for their careers. When you saw this, you were on duty, you say, with a group of paramedics. Did you talk to them about what you'd seen? Because clearly it would have been distracting you from the work that you were doing.
Well, ironically, we'd just come out of a house where we were dealing, I can't remember the exact incident, but there was two paramedics, myself and my partner, and a couple of other officers that I called in, having witnessed what I'd seen. And it was when the other officers arrived, my wife and her partner, that this ball of fire actually came back round again. It had disappeared, but it came round for the second time. Basically, I won't use the expletives on the radio, but basically, in a nutshell, the paramedics looked and said, what the is that?
This is a fantastic story. Have you got this in the newspapers? You should be getting this in the Birmingham Mail.
I've contacted several newspapers, and ironically, none of them seem to be interested.
Well, I've got to say, if you went to and you told them that you were ex-uniformed service and this had happened, I think most mainstream newspapers would probably carry your account. That's very strange that they didn't.
I've actually said I'm an ex-police officer. I've even contacted groups that have been set up for police officers who have seen these things, and I've contacted mainstream newspapers. I've contacted local newspapers where these events have happened, and yep, thanks, bye, and never bothered to get back to me. So that is obviously a matter for them to justify.
You've got a chapter in this ebook, They Walk Among Us. Talk to me about that.
They do. And again...
And who are they?
Well, they are people who are not you would standardly know as being from this planet. So when you walk around, you see lots and lots of other human beings, and you understand that they are the same as you. There's an instant, and I've also spoke to other people in America as well who have had the same sort of accounts, where myself,
a wife,
and a friend, so there was three of us, we were in Birmingham, and all of a sudden, this person, for want of a better expression, walked past us. My insides felt like they were a washing machine. His face looked like his skin had been contorted over the cheeks of his skull. His eyes were black, and his hair looked like he could have been hundreds of years old. It was very sort of grey, thin, fibery, and he was about 6'3" tall. And trust me, he was not from here. He was from not from this place. Mm. He was a strange entity. And when I've spoken to other people in America, some quite famous people in ufology as well, the likes of Whitley Strieber, who was the author of the hit book and movie adaptation.
You've spoken to Whitley. I know Whitley.
Yeah, I know Whitley as well. I speak to him quite regularly. I've been on his show as well. Mm-hmm. And Whitley as well, this where he's seen, or people have seen, not him necessarily, but people who he knows have seen entities, and they are strange. Some of them are like typical greys with oval black eyes and things, and they've been standing in the middle of libraries or standing in the middle of shops, and people have been walking by them unaware that they're even there. So it just makes you believe what are these people actually seeing? Are they putting up some kind of facade where people are not actually seeing their true appearance?
You talked about your wife. Is she there now?
My wife is not here now, but obviously we live in the same house, but she's not present at the moment.
I was just thinking at some point I'd love to speak with her as well.
Yeah, Bab, I'm sure she'd be happy with that. What I've seen in terms of ufology and the ET being, she was there with me as well.
Okay, well, I hear what you say. Well, you also have something on your website about the secrets of Stonehenge. What is there about Stonehenge that we don't know?
Well, what I've found, again, using 17 years of investigative knowledge, is I've looked into many ancient cultures, like the Egyptians and the pyramids all around the world. I've looked into Stonehenge. I've looked into the likes of Atlantis and Lemuria. I've looked into all of these ancient monuments and even the Bible. And what I've actually found is something that I call the ancient code, because the ancients have left a secret code within all of these monuments, within all of the biblical scriptures, that are speaking of the same thing. And that code can be summed up in two words: enlightened consciousness. And the whole of these monuments were built as a, almost like a power station, to enhance their own sort of inner Christ, their own inner sun. And the likes of the Great Pyramid was a gigantic power station that would amplify this consciousness.
Which a lot of researchers are saying now, that it was some kind of power generating or power receiving device. But where are the message? Where's the code on Stonehenge? I've been to Stonehenge many times. I've looked at those big stones. Where's that code written?
Well, the code is actually in the monument itself. You'll notice that it's a circle. It's a 360-degree circle, which is a primary halo, a concentric circle. But some of the stones originally were in the shape of an oval. And the oval is basically the thalamus, which is the inner sun of consciousness inside the brain. And what they were doing, some of the stones of Stonehenge, such as the Presley Blue Stones, have seven bands of energy which connect to the seven chakras of the human body. They balance them. And what they were doing at Stonehenge, they were actually harnessing Earth's energy through sound waves. And they were using this concentric circle and their balanced vessel. And they were harnessing this serpent energy of Earth. And it was actually raising their own inner consciousness, their own awareness. So the secret is actually in the monuments themselves. Within the Great Pyramid, yes, there are many people that are saying there are some kind of power stations, but what they're not realizing and what they're not saying is that the Great Pyramid marks the exact location of the three master glands of the third eye of the human brain, which deals with consciousness. And where you have the pineal gland is where you have the king's chamber. Where you have the pituitary gland is where you have the queen's chamber. It is that chemical marriage of the two opposites. And you also have in there the chamber, which is the thalamus, and that is Isis, Osiris, and Horus in Egyptian mythology. But it's basically marking the exact spot of the endocrine system of the human brain, which is the consciousness master glands.
So it's all representative, you think?
The Great Pyramid is a giant replica of the human consciousness, and what they were doing through various mathematical codes and sequences, like the Fibonacci sequence, the golden ratio, the golden pi, they're not there just for mathematical sake. They're there because these numbers give a frequency. You know, the Fibonacci sequence and the golden ratio give a frequency of 432 hertz, which is known as the miracle tone. Pi gives us 528 hertz, which again is God consciousness. So all of these mathematical formulations within these monuments are conscious raising frequencies. So the Great Pyramid itself is a giant replica of the human brain, but it is also a powerhouse that is amplifying the exact point of consciousness, and it is basically beaming out radio signals, the same as the Eds of Easter Island, the same as Stonehenge, the same as all of these ancient monuments.
Beaming out radio, you're not beaming out radio signals now.
The Great Pyramid isn't, because if you notice some of the shafts of the pyramid, there are massive stones that have been put in the shafts. They have been decommissioned.
So you think that it would be resonating, it would be radiating now if that wasn't so?
Yes, and some pyramids still are. Some people have actually witnessed beams of light coming out the likes of the Bosnian pyramids. Now, what is happening there is because these ancient stones are actually inside Earth, embedded in Earth, they are absorbing Earth's energies and they are transmuting them into electromagnetic beams of light. So when you see the likes of the Bosnian pyramids, they are still active when people are seeing beams of light coming out of the top of them. But the Great Pyramid, to bear in mind that the Great Pyramid is the exact centre of the landmass of Earth. So it really is the spider in the middle of the web of the Earth's ley lines.
Okay, now we've covered an awful lot of ground, and sadly we're out of time. And I said this was going to be an introduction to you. Last question. Why do you think that you have been singled out to pass on all of this information? Why do you think you, former police officer, and in fact it was happening while you were a serving police officer, why this has come to you and not to others?
That's a very, very good question. Certainly in 2009, I kept seeing a strange golden key in my mind, and it was sort of driving me mad as to why I kept seeing a golden key. And when I actually looked into the meaning of golden key, it is the Gnostic principle of knowledge. It is the worthiness to receive ancient secret knowledge. I've been visited by an Egyptian pharaoh. By an Egyptian pharaoh who was walking alongside me.
And what did the Egyptian pharaoh say?
The Egyptian pharaoh didn't say anything. He was basically in full headdress. It sort of started off strangely, really. In 2010, before the wife and I went to Egypt, we had a strange message from a psychic medium from Scotland who I'd never spoken to, didn't know. And she basically told me that she had a message that something was going to happen when I went to Egypt that was going to basically unlock sacred knowledge, and that my own personal energy changed as a result of this encounter in Egypt. And this was in 2010. It was only in 2017 that message actually started to make sense, with a lot of visitation and a lot of sort of sacred ancient information that was just dropping into my head. So why have I been chosen? Good question. I don't actually know, but I have been, and there's lots and lots of information that is coming to me that is piecing together a complete different blueprint of ancient history.
And what do you want to do with this? Do you want to, you know, go on mainstream media talking about this, you know, or do you think that you're happy to do with what you're doing, publishing stuff yourself?
I do, because I think it's important that people have an alternative view. I think it's important that people realise that there's something much more going on than what they are being taught. And as I said, the mainstream are very, very reluctant to actually, you know, I've offered to go to a museum and you know, at my own expense, but they're not interested. And people have actually got back to me and said, no, thank you, we're mainstream. Now, there's a lot of resistance to what I'm trying to say, but my view is the more people that understand about their own greatness, the less they are being fooled by the accounts that the mainstream history are giving them.
And just this point, when you were on shift with those paramedics and others who had that experience of the fireball, did you try later to get everybody together and go public about this?
No, because the other people concerned, apart from myself and my wife, were reluctant to be heard.
Hmm. And I suppose, again, you know, if they don't want to do it, they don't want to do it, and there's nothing you can do about that.
Well, no, we're not in the business to try and force people to actually say something. But they were there, they witnessed it, we spoke about it. But it's only myself and my wife that have actually publicly documented what we saw that night.
Okay.
And many other nights.
Okay. So this has been an introduction to Mike Feely. We've covered a lot of ground. Tell me what your website is.
Thank you. It is www.michael-feely.com.
And if my listeners want to email you about what they've heard, are you happy with them doing that?
Absolutely. I'll reply to each and every one of them.
Okay. You heard the website address. I'll put a link to it on my website. If you have thoughts about what you've heard, then Michael says that he's quite happy to hear from you. Michael, thank you very much indeed, and please take care.
Thank you. You too.
Michael Feely. I'll put a link to him and his work on my website, theunexplained.tv. We're right out of time. Thank you very much for being part of my show. More great guests in the pipeline here at The Unexplained, so until next we meet here. My name is Howard Hughes. This has been The Unexplained. And until that next session of The Unexplained, please stay safe, please stay calm, and above all, please stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.